In a constantly changing world, today is as simple as it gets. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast to explore, experiment, and power up your leadership to make the difference to your business, your people, and your success. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we dig deep into global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
So welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma, and I'm extremely excited today that I have Radhika Gupta joining me, who's currently the CEO of Edelweiss Asset Management. Now, Radhika's been the CEO for 3 years, and whilst we sit in different countries and we're about to have a conversation in the midst of a global pandemic, she tells me that this is the first crisis that she's had to deal with as CEO, but that's not where our story is going to start. But before we start, Radhika, I just want to say a massive thank you for taking the time to join us on this podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Adam. Very excited.
Absolute pleasure to have you. Now, we're really going to be talking about the power of storytelling in the context of leadership. And you have a story to tell. So let me kick things off and say you were the daughter of a diplomat. So let's start there, because that in itself really created a way of life for you.
It did, Adam. And, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, I'm kind of sitting home in the middle of lockdown, and I think the lockdown, and people keep asking me, how's life in lockdown and how have you adapted to this change? Because anyone who knows me as sort of a leader knows that I'm someone who loves my office. I used to travel 3 days a week to different cities in India. You know, I love the formal dressing. And then this is a big change. Like, I haven't been home for so long, ever. When I roamed around with my dad, I mean, he moved every 3 years.
Right.
And the very nice thing is that the Indian government has a super democratic system. So they rank countries in the world on the A to C. So A is like the cool countries to live in, where like life is really nice.
Yeah.
And C is like really tough countries to live in. And they're like some C-star countries, which are like really, really tough. And when you get an A country, right after that, you get punished with the C country and then C to A. So you couldn't move. So, I mean, I moved from Pakistan, where I was born, to New York, which was like A star.
Okay.
And then I moved to Delhi. And then I moved to Lagos, Nigeria, which I have great stories about. And then I moved to Italy. So there is so much change that you're used to dealing with and so much extremes that I'm actually very grateful for my background now.
So it sounds like you've gone from one extreme to the other. So maybe someone who enjoys the office and now in lockdown, you're still going from one extreme to another.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it is a complete extreme. And I have to say, I'm really enjoying this. I mean, there was word that the lockdown in India is going to be extended further. And I tell you, I can sit and do this for 2 more months and I would be very, very happy.
Even as the CEO of an asset management company, you can still work from home. I think that's important.
I can, and I have to tell you, my team, I just did a review before this call. My team's productivity on most accounts has been higher in April, May of lockdown than in normal course.
It means that the ways of working may actually change when we move out of this, that's for sure. But tell us a little bit more about your childhood, because as you say, as the daughter of a diplomat, you were used to change, you were used to maybe uncertainty, to travel to different cultures. And just tell us a little bit more about your background, because that says a lot about, you know, who you are and the person that you've become.
It does. So I was born in Pakistan, and it's very unconventional for an Indian citizen to be born in Pakistan. We have rivalry that extends to politics and a history of warfare and, of course, the cricket field. So it's very strange for an Indian to be born in Pakistan. If you say that in India, people immediately look at you. They're like, oh, you? Okay, yeah. So that was that. When I was born, I grew up, as I said, speaking entirely Hindi and Urdu, which is the local language of Pakistan. And thereafter, my father was moved to the US. I think I was 4 years old when I moved. And I recall my mother saying that I didn't know a damn word of English when I moved to the US. So there was that battle to learn English. And then I have to tell you a funny story. 3-4 years after I had finally figured out how to speak English, they got moved to Delhi.
Right.
And they applied to public school admission for me. And the guy gave me a test, an admission test in the Hindi language. And I submitted a blank test back because I just didn't know any Hindi because I had spent 4 years trying to figure English out. And so then, you know, they admitted me because I did well on everything else, like the math and the science and stuff. But I just couldn't speak Hindi. So my mom actually locked me in a room, I think for a month, and taught me Hindi so that I could join school. And I think I got an 85% in Hindi in third grade, which is like the crowning academic glory of my life.
Right.
But yeah, there was a lot of movement from city to city and country to country, and also language to language, which is very interesting. And then again, when they moved to Nigeria 3 years later, you know, it was a very interesting time for India because people, I mean, India was also changing. So I remember going to Nigeria and people, like, they had a very different impression of India from what it is today. I remember classmates asking me, like, do you have snake charmers around you and do you, like, go to school with elephants? I'm not kidding. Like, I was in seventh grade and I was asked this question. And at that point, there was an American sitcom called The Simpsons, which you may be familiar with.
Yes.
There was a character in The Simpsons called Apu. And everyone used to, he was the Indian guy. That was like the Indian stereotype. So I remember being called Apu for the first 3 years in Nigeria. And I have to say, that was a pretty tough part of childhood because I went, being a teenage girl is pretty cruel no matter which part of the world you grow up in, especially if you don't look like anyone else and if, you know, you have braces and you're naughty looking and you're quite overweight, which I was. I mean, I'm appalled looking at some of my childhood pictures. So that was a pretty tough time. And Nigeria is also not a place where you can do very much, Adam. So it's actually like living in quasi-lockdown in Nigeria. You can't go out.
You've had practice already at lockdown.
I have amazing practice in lockdown because in Nigeria, you can't go out after 6 o'clock. Your car has a bulletproof door. Your house has a bulletproof door and bulletproof windows. And there are no malls. There are no places to buy clothes. Or that was what it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
In fact, all my clothes were tailored. I mean, there was a market. It was a cloth market called Yaba. And my mother and I used to go there and we would pick up cloth. And then there would be this Nigerian tailor who would come home and sit and make these clothes for us. And if you look at my pictures from those ages, I mean, I'm mortified. Like, even my prom dress from high school was made by a local tailor. And as I said in one of my talks, he used to put fake labels on those clothes. To make them. This is my childhood, a very, very entertaining childhood.
How many countries have you lived in then?
I have lived in 6 countries, 4 continents as a kid.
Wow. See, that's an amazing lesson in itself, isn't it? For someone growing up and in those impressionable years as a youngster and as a teenager, that's a lot of culture to take in.
It is. And the good thing is, you know, it's, you adapt to people very quickly. So, I mean, you just get along with people. It helps me in the CEO role too. I mean, because as an asset management CEO, I have about 200 people who work with me and there are people in their 50s and there are people in their 20s and there are people who are like, the young marketing guys who are a different kind of breed than the senior serious investment types. And it just, you know, your personality is very tuned to working with different kinds of people because that's what you've seen in your childhood. I also think, Adam, living in a country is very different from traveling there as a tourist. Like, I've traveled tons of countries as tourists, but one, you would never go to Nigeria as a tourist. I mean, I hope you don't. There's not that much to see.
I haven't done yet.
I wouldn't recommend it, but I think when you go somewhere and you live somewhere, I mean, it's a really day-to-day thing. Like, you know, I actually never saw all those tourist sites in Italy where I went to high school till a year before we have to leave. But I know a lot about how Italians think and about how that culture works. And so I think it gives you a very different experience that you can't get as a tourist.
So that's, I mean, that in itself is an amazing experience. But I want to mention as well, because some people may know your name or they may even have watched a fantastic video, which I watched. I know it's been now viewed on YouTube quite an extraordinary amount of time, about 120,000 times or more. And that video is called The Girl with the Broken Neck. And you gave a speech on stage, which was really quite inspiring. Just tell us a little bit about that, because that is, again, the essence of you, isn't it?
It is, and I have to tell you, I went to a workshop once on storytelling that was part of something that Edelweiss had organized. And I'm pretty cynical about workshops in general. I'm like, what am I going to learn in 2 days? And that workshop completely changed my life. And it just talked about the power of using stories and how they connect. And one of the exercises we did in that workshop is we had a group of 20 leaders at Edelweiss all kind of give a little mini TED talk, unprepared, unrehearsed, anything. I mean, just talk about life.
Okay.
And that's the first time the genesis of God with a Broken Neck came out. And I don't know what it was about that environment that kind of got me talking, mm-hmm. but I did the talking. And when I started sharing the story, and the funny thing is the story of Girl with a Broken Neck is not a story anybody around me knew in completion. So my husband didn't know it in completion. My parents didn't know it in completion. It was all within me.
Okay.
And it finally came out on stage. And I'm so happy I did it. I did it as a lark. I thought, why not share a story with others? But about every day, Adam, I get 2-3 stories and messages from around the world with people who connect to that story. 2 days ago, I got a message from someone in France, and he called his email, the boy with a broken neck. And instantly, he has the same issue, and he sent me his x-ray of the neck and how he's trying to figure it out. And Saturday, I got someone, it was a girl living in Delhi, and she's got a big bald patch on her head, and she was talking about how she's grappling with that and how that's affecting her self-confidence, and maybe the video will give her a little bit of confidence. So I think that's the power of sharing an individual story. It just can travel anywhere.
So it's so people aren't just connecting with you in relation to a specific condition, but they're seeing the adversity, the challenge that you talk about passionately in the video. That's what they're connecting with.
Yeah, and that's what they connect with. And, you know, some people connect. There's a part in the video I talk about, which a lot of people can relate to perhaps, which is my living in Nigeria and like the love of wanting to wear branded clothes because your friends are wearing branded clothes, but not being able to afford them. And a friend of mine who's the CEO at a tech company called me and he said, that's what I connected to because for years I bought like fake clothes on the roads of Bombay. And I just remember like, you know, envying my friend, you know, who had like the branded Nike clothes.
Now, do you think that a lot of, you know, this background in relation to, you know, being the daughter of a diplomat and the travel and the culture, and as you say, growing up with this condition you talked about, the girl with the broken neck, do you think that was all part and parcel of what inspired you to create your initial capital management company in 2005? As you say, you pulled together enough rupees in order to start that. But do you think that really was the catalyst for you to be so determined?
I think our background does make us persistent, but more than that, the background makes you want change. So I think I mean, if you look at the origins of Forefront Capital, and it's interesting to talk about this in the middle of the COVID crisis, it was a business that was born out of crisis. I mean, we were sitting in the US in 2008 and Wall Street was going through hell at that point.
Yes.
Had just survived the layoffs, had not gotten laid off, which was really a relief. But, you know, one of the things about my father's profession is that there was a change every 3 years. And I think I had completed 3-4 years on Wall Street. And I was bored. I mean, I wanted a change. I wanted to do something more. And I think that's a constant in my career that, you know, every 3-4 years, you're asking yourself, can I do more? Can I do more? Can I push myself a little bit? Can I make a change? So I keep trying to say I'm a child of chaos. I mean, I'm one of those people who adapt to change and chaos really well. And I think that's where the origins of Forefront Capital Management came, because I have never lived in India. So it's pretty random in some sense to be 25 and come back to India and start something of your own in a country you've never lived in. But I was very comfortable with the change. And, you know, I came back to India and funny enough, we were 3 partners who started the firm. And obviously we had no money because whatever money we had, we pooled into the company. So we couldn't afford a lawyer to file the application with the regulator. And suddenly we found out that I was going to, and I know you're a barrister, so you're going to laugh at me. But I actually became the quasi lawyer. I learned everything about the law and I'm still half decent at it. And I became the tax person. And I did a lot of that initial bootstrapping. And I think the background makes you adapt to change very easily.
Is that classic entrepreneurial spirit as well, that you become, you have to be almost the jack of many trades because you've got to the high powered meeting and you've got to empty the bins, you've got to stack the chairs, and as you say, you've got to draft the documents. You have to do it all,
and you have to kind of pull it together. I mean, it's and I consider my mom a super inspiration. I mean, you know, in a startup, you just have to be super resourceful. And this was my mom, right? When I needed a gown for prom, she went to a tailor and found a tailor to make a gown, and she found a tailor to make a swimsuit. I mean, she didn't stop. So she found a way to get it done. And, you know, that's what a diplomatic background teaches you. You have to find a way to get it done. In Nigeria, there was no milk. So we used to have milk made of milk powder. But
It's probably like people will remember that probably from war rations.
Yeah, but that was our life. For 3 years, we had milk made with milk powder. And that was life. And I think that's entrepreneurship. Sometimes you have to make milk from milk powder.
So shuttle forward slightly for us, because obviously you took a risk. You came to India, you got together, you said the money that you got together, you were doing multiple roles. I'm sure all of you were. How did you then become to be the CEO Edelweiss Asset Management, which was 3 years ago, I think you started that role. Join those dots for me.
So, the business had its struggles in its early days, and it literally grew brick by brick. And I tell anybody out there that I don't think there's a recipe to get from 1 to 100. We started with a tiny quantum of money, but it grew multiple hundred times by the time we could sell the business to Edelweiss. So Edelweiss Financial Services is a large financial services firm in India. It's like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or any of these large financial firms globally. We do everything except being a bank. So we ended up selling the business to them, 5 years after founding it. And a lot of people also ask me how the business grew. And I don't think there's a recipe, Adam, to go from 1 to 100. I think, you know how to go from 1 to 2. And maybe once you get to 2, you can go from 2 to 5. And hopefully when you're at 5, you have some idea of how you can get to 10. And, at 10, you have some confidence to get to 50, and life charts its course. So I think that's how the business grew, brick by brick. And I joined Edelweiss in 2014 when the acquisition happened. I built the business they had acquired for a few years. And then in 2017, a company called JP Morgan Mutual Fund had sold its business to Edelweiss. I was again itching to do something new. You'll feel that 3-year diplomatic itch comes back.
I'm hearing a theme, Radhika.
Oh, it's such a theme. So the itch came back. I told the guys and I said, I've been working with high net worth and institutional, but my heart is really in working with small consumers, average Indians, finding financial solutions for them. I want to run the mutual fund business. Again, it's a business I don't come from, but I've jumped into it 3 years ago, and touch wood, it's been a very good 3 years. Again, you'll see the theme of jumping into something new and trying to, find some success in it.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you've got 200 people now, I think, in Edelweiss working for you, and there'll be a variety of ages. But you are a young CEO. So tell us a little bit more about how you found empathy and human connection that served you now as a leader of a business.
Oh, yeah. This conversation makes me feel good because you called me young. But I was 33 when I became the CEO of the firm. So yes, definitely young. And India is a culturally tricky place because, nowhere is it easy to have people who report to you who are significantly older. As a leader, you can't be overwhelmed by that. It's also a trickier challenge when you don't come from the industry where you've just been made a CEO. And I think it's here that I found, I have to think about what I can add to people's lives. And what I can really add is compassion, empathy, and the ability to bring people together. Mm-hmm. Storytelling has done that well. I think when people look at you as a CEO, there's a limited connect you have with them. But I think when people look at you as a human being, there's a far richer connect. And that human connect comes when I share my struggles and when I share my stories. I think that's when they can relate to me. Some of the guys who work with me are 50, 55. I might be a little older than their daughters. But hopefully through storytelling, we're trying to build something shared. We're also building stories of the future. This mutual fund, that journey that I started, there are 44 mutual fund companies in India. We were ranked 40th or 37th or something when we started this. We're now ranked 16th, which is a lot of progress in 3 years. We built a shared story for the future we want to have. And I think, by the way, the crisis has given us a lot of opportunities to share stories, that will hold us together. So I found that storytelling is a way to rally people together, to give them a vision for the future, and also to keep them connected. I don't believe the model, the old school model of leadership, which is the corner office. I think you have to be there front and center, visit your branches. I have 23 branches all over the country. Be there for your people, especially at times like this, digitally or physically.
that it's always harder at a time like this because we've lacked the physical proximity. But you've said something that really resonates. You said that, you know, as the CEO, if you see the title, if you just see the position of CEO, there is some connection. But if you see, you hear, and you get to know the human, that's when you get the maximum connection.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think you don't, the title will give you maybe aura. And I'm very grateful for the title, and it gives you opportunity and gives you a platform.
Yes.
But what you make of it comes from the human connection. I don't think, Adam, the many letters I get are in the capacity of CEO. I mean, the most heartwarming letters like this X-ray I talked to you about, or the girl with a bald patch, they don't come to me in the capacity of CEO of Edelweiss Asset Management. I mean, India has hundreds of CEOs. They come to me in the capacity of the girl with the broken neck, because that's the story they can relate to.
And as you say, that's the human connection piece. That's something that they can connect with. They can see a commonality with.
Yeah. And I think when you see we're all flawed. We've all failed. We've all had struggles. So have CEOs. I mean, there are days, everybody has a day in the month where they hate their world, they hate their life, and they want to quit that job. But when you act invincible and when you act perfect, no one can connect to that. But if you tell your team, listen, I'm struggling with this, I need help, I just think people give you more help than you could ever ask for.
Now, you said at the start, or I think I said at the start, that this is your first crisis that you're dealing with as CEO. Are there some things that, because we never stop learning, are there some things that you're learning out of this crisis, either on a personal level or from a leadership level?
Oh my God, so many. And I mean, it's the list goes on and on. But I think one is that people, you know, it reiterates the fact that humans are tremendously resilient and tremendously adaptable. You know, there are so many times we've had conversations in my office about doing things digitally, and they just, you know, they were happening and they were kind of slow, et cetera, et cetera.
At their own pace.
But COVID has become the new chief technology officer in my office. We are able to create so much impact digitally. We used to do a bunch of these ground events with hundreds of people, and we've completely transformed that into a digital event business for our mutual fund business. We are reaching out to more people. We're doing it at lower cost. We're doing better events, and we're so excited. We're going to continue this after the lockdown. So I think every crisis is a genuine opportunity to adapt, and people adapt. I think as a leader, the biggest learning has been, and it's a reiteration, be vulnerable and be honest. There have been really bad days on this crisis. I mean, there have been some really horrible ones. But my solution has been to tell my team I'm struggling with something and I need help. I don't think leadership is a burden that you need to carry on your own shoulders the entire time. You need to have 4 or 5 people on your team that you can trust, and you need to go out and say, listen, I need a little help. And I think the third one personally for me is, one of the things I started 3 years ago is I started creating this concept of a personal advisory board, which is a group of 4 to 5 people who I respect deeply and who I know care about me, who I could turn to for advice. And I started putting this group together in my head and spending time with them. And I think that group has been invaluable at this time as I've grappled with my own choices.
I think that's so important when you talk about a personal advisory board, because it doesn't matter who you are or what position or title, everyone needs someone.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you need, my advisory board has a ex-official from the Indian Army. It has a lawyer. It has someone from my own industry. It has people from different industries, different age groups. I mean, it's really diverse, but I can't tell you how many times I've counted on it, especially in this crisis.
So the one thing I want to come back to, because again, this really resonates. You say you were a 33-year-old CEO, and something that leaders grapple with is leading people who are older than them, or even may know more than them. But you seem to have a very comfortable with a level of vulnerability. Where do you think that comes from? That might be an obvious question, but where do you think that vulnerability or the comfortableness with being vulnerable comes from for you?
It wasn't natural, I have to say. You know, I was brought up like everyone else in a background, especially I think in India, we're taught not to showcase vulnerability. You want to showcase strength. For me, broken neck was definitely the transformative moment because I realized what vulnerability can do.
What year did that happen, Radhika? Remind me, what year did that video come out?
Yeah, that happened in 2018.
Right.
And I think that was a game changer because I saw, you know, some of, and my father has been someone, I adore him, but he's not been the vulnerable archetype. But when Broken Neck released, he was perhaps the most happy. And there were colleagues of his who were 75 that were calling him and telling him how much that story meant to them. So, and how it had changed their views about vulnerability. And I think that really was it for me because I was not this person 3 years ago. I really was not.
Right. It's amazing, isn't it, that sometimes something happens in life which we see as a pivotal moment or a catalyst for a change, either a change in us or a change in how we outwardly behave. It sounds like it was a huge connector for you. You connected with people from all over the world.
Oh, yeah. And I still do. And, you know, I genuinely get overwhelmed at the kind of messages I get from people around the world. There was a guy in Pakistan who called me. He's got a problem in his cheek. Physical disabilities, emotional disabilities, all kinds of people. A lot of fathers, you know, one of the nicest things was a lot of fathers writing to me that they watch it with their daughters and it was a bonding exercise with their daughters. And I guess, Adam, you know, we all have stories within us. And we're privileged if our story can bring joy and inspiration to someone else's life. I mean, if your vulnerability can do that for someone, then it's really a gift, isn't it?
Well, I hope what people will also do when they've listened to this podcast is also go and watch that video because I watched it and it's a fabulous story. And I say it's now, you know, I'm going to rewatch that because it's nice to know that that was such a pivotal moment in your life that actually changed things for you.
Yeah, and I've done about 220 public speaking talks after that. It also gave me a hobby. I love to speak and ironically, I was very shy as a kid and very shy with the stage. And I'm even using storytelling in my business, which is financial services, trying to make financial concepts easier. You're going to laugh, but, one of the concepts we talk about in money is holding on for the long term. And I run this series called Malts and Money. It's inspired by Scotland. And it talks about how whiskey takes very little time to make, but so long to mature. And, you know, the whole story of how that connects to money. So I use all kinds of stories in my profession, and I find it very interesting and very powerful.
Well, that was a lovely little segue you offered me there, because I'm going to ask you three slightly different questions now. And the first one, you may have answered it, is what is your hobby? It might be a hobby at the moment because we are living in lockdown or coming perhaps towards the end of lockdown. But what is a hobby that you would like to share with us?
Oh, it's writing. I love to write short stories. I love to write poetry. And one day I hope to write a book.
Well, I can recommend it. It takes some time, but it's great fun at the end of it, that's for sure. Well, if that's the case, then this is a neat segue into the second question. What's your favorite word?
No one's asked me this, but I have a word. The word is chutzpah. I love the way it sounds. It's just very out there. And I love what it means, which is this audaciousness and this confidence to just do the unthinkable. And I think as a young leader, it's something I resonate with.
That's chutzpah, yeah?
Yeah.
Gotcha. I think that's a Yiddish word, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah, I think it is.
I think chutzpah, a Yiddish word, which is great. All right. And then here's a good question for you, Radhika. What would be your best advice to a 21-year-old Radhika?
So my advice would be collect experiences. Let me explain that. Because I think when you're 21 or when I was 21,
yes.
You were taught collect labels. It's important to have a fancy degree and it's important to work for really fancy organizations, etc. And while that's all good, don't let your career be that. Do interesting things. I've done a lot of different things. Worked for a startup, worked for a mid-sized firm, worked in India, worked overseas within India, done things for high net worth, done things for retail, worked with government. Collect different experiences. It'll make you a very rich individual. And I think when you're 21, you should focus on collecting experiences that will teach you things.
And Radhika, I absolutely love that piece of advice. And I think that is something that I'm going to be telling my teenagers as well. So if you're happy, I'm going to take that and run with it. It's been absolutely a pleasure. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I hope that you'll join us again in a couple of months and come back to the Leadership Enigma and we can share some more stories.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. This was great fun.
It's a pleasure. Stay safe. And I look forward to, I hope we'll meet one day in Mumbai.
Yes, I'm looking forward after lockdown to welcome you to Mumbai.
Radhika, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Join us again next week for more essential insights on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or via our website, www.pca-global.com. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for listening.